Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm in the garden, virtually, unfortunately, not really, with Robert Pavlis, a chemist who has a 6-acre garden near Ontario, Canada, in USDA Zone 5, i.e. minus 20 degrees C, seriously cold. Robert is well known for looking at published scientific papers to verify whether what we do in the garden makes sense scientifically. Garden Myths is his much-celebrated broadcast, and he has two books on the subject. What would you say, Robert? Well, first of all, it's lovely to have you here. But what would you say is the myth that you found that most gardeners found is the most outstanding?
Outstanding. I think one of the most important ones for people to understand is this idea that there is a specialized fertilizer for each type of plant. Right. So We can go to the store and we can buy rose fertilizer and tomato fertilizer and African violet fertilizer and so on. OK, those things don't actually exist. And people spend a lot of time online trying to find the right fertilizer for a particular type of plant. And it just doesn't exist. All plants basically use the same nutrients in this relatively the same amounts. And the idea that we're actually feeding plants is incorrect anyway. So they're simply getting nutrients from the soil. So I think that one probably has the biggest impact on gardeners.
I think that came about, I don't know what you think, but because so with soap powders, you know, one soap firm would produce 20 soap powders because they want to have a big market share. Yeah. So do you think that's why all these different concentrations of fertilizers came out?
Yeah, I think it's a marketing thing, right? It's easy for someone everybody grows roses. So you go to the store, you want rose fertilizer, it's there, it's marked, you don't have to think about it, right? You buy that, right? Mm. And the next time you go to the store, you need tomato fertilizer. Oh, well, that's different. So I will buy some of that as well.
Mm.
And it's a marketing thing. It makes it easy for people. They don't have to imagine all the fertilizers weren't labeled that way. They were just fertilizer and they all had different formulas. People would go to the store and go, I don't know which one to pick, right? So they're lost. So it helps the manufacturer point them to a particular product.
Yeah. Yes, I think it is mainly for marketing, for money-making purposes, really.
Yeah.
But before we get into your new book, which is coming out shortly, which is all about food science and how gardeners can grow, harvest and prepare nutrient-dense food, which I think sounds fascinating. Can you just describe a bit about your own garden to me? I gather it's 6 acres that you designed and built it. It's near Ontario in Canada. Tell me your design concept, how many days a week you spend maintaining it, and basically what sort of your favorite plants in it.
Well, when we bought the property about 19 years ago, I went into semi-retirement. I had a software business and I decided to work there 3 days a week and garden 4 days a week. So I was pretty much
What age was that?
About 55.
Ooh, very young. Yes.
Actually, before that, in my early 50s, yeah.
Gosh. And you thought 6 acres would put you into retirement. I bet you work harder now than you did before, would you say?
Oh, I work at least as hard now as before, yes. Six acres is a lot of property.
Yeah.
One of the first things I learned was that you don't walk from one end of the garden to the other to pick up a shovel because it'll kill you. You have to plan ahead and drive when we're on the property.
Right. And so describe your design concept. I mean, I've seen pictures of it and it's sort of flowing beds and lots of plants. I couldn't see so much grass, but heavily planted with about 3,000 different types of plants.
Yeah. The property had a large area of grass around the house, but four of those acres were pretty much wild. So I have a maple sugar bush and some other areas that are just kind of wild, weedy things. And I had a little meadow out the back. And so what I did was I took the grassy areas and turned them into more formal gardens. But when I say formal, they're not highly formal because the whole surrounding area is wild, right? So I have a house, I have semi-formal gardens around the house, and then as you move away from the house, they get less and less formal.
Yeah.
And there's two reasons for that. The main one is it's less work, right? When you're one person trying to take care of a large garden, you don't want it too formal. Formal is great, but it's a lot more work. And the other reason was it just as you look out into the garden and away from the house, it was very informal. It's a wild woodland area. And so I wanted to kind of merge those two. I didn't want to have a sudden transition. I wanted that transition to be very, very soft. And so the beds right around the house are a little more formal. And then as you get away from the house, they get a little less formal and so on.
And is it mainly herbaceous and conifers? It looked that sort of regime from what
Yeah,
I the pictures.
lots of shrubs, because they're lower maintenance work. Lots of herbaceous plants. I don't really grow any annuals, so anything I grow has to survive on its own. I focus very much on low maintenance plants, again because of the time that it takes. So things that need to be dug up every couple of years and split, they don't usually survive very long. I want things that are going to be there for 10 years and I don't have to touch them.
And how many days a week do you spend doing it? And do you do it all yourself?
Well, I up until about a year ago, I did it all myself, and it was about 4 days a week.
Right, 4 man days a week. That's quite a lot of maintenance, isn't it, really? And why did you decide that you wanted 6 acres? Because don't you think now, actually, if I'd have done half an acre and let the rest go natural, I could sit in the deck chair more often? Or you don't ever think that you've actually bitten off quite a lot? Because I think we tend to do that. I think many gardeners, they have a bare, a bare space, and they think, wow, I'm going to do this. And they don't actually realise the work implications.
Yeah. Well, my wife originally wanted about an acre of property, but you see, I have an acre of flower beds now, so that wouldn't have been big enough.
Yeah.
6 acres is maybe a bit more than I need. I'd rather have too much than not enough.
Yeah.
But it really had to do with the property. It's an area called Rolling Hills. So it's full of small hills. So in that 6 acres, I have very high areas, I have low areas, I have little valleys, and it flows really nice from one to the other. It's a perfect property for a gardener. I even have a part of a natural pond on that property. And
Yeah.
so it's just really ideal for gardening.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. But your climate, I would find your climate difficult. I think it is like mine. What would be your lowest temperature you've ever experienced?
I think we go down to like minus 30 centigrade.
That is cold. And in the summer, it gets mega hot, presumably.
We're fairly hot and we're also muggy in the summer.
What sort of temperature, fairly hot, do you call it?
So we'll get up to 90.
Which would be, that's
90 Fahrenheit.
Right. So that would be in centigrade, sort of 30, would it be?
Yeah.
Veg, presumably you grow a lot of veg yourself.
I don't actually. I have a small garden, but I got to the point where I can go and buy fresh vegetables when they're in season. I can't go and buy rare perennials and rare shrubs. So I focus on that instead.
So you really are a plantsman, would you
Yes.
say? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's your thing. But you actually qualified as a biochemist, is that right? Well, your university degree.
Yeah, I'm a chemist and biochemist. I have a master's in biochemistry.
Yeah.
And a teaching certificate. So I think that's where I migrated over to, writing books and doing lectures and teaching people about gardening. So I kind of bring all that those things together. Gardening for me has always just been a hobby. It's never been part of my business.
Yeah. No, interesting. So really then your new book sounds really interesting because I don't think I've ever seen any book on evaluating how nutrient dense our food is that we grow and how we can make it more nutrient dense. And so I think gardeners will find it really, really interesting. And presumably, when you approached a subject like this, you would trawl through the scientific literature, through the papers and things like that. Is that the way you do it? And do which scientific search engines do you use the most? Sort of Google Scholar or
I use Google Scholar almost exclusively for that.
Yeah.
The interest I have is in trying to better understand things about plants and in this case, food and nutrition. And I
Yeah.
approach things from the point of view is I generally look at the popular information first. So I just go on Google articles and bloggers and so on, see what the general public is saying about a subject. And then I go and look at that information and try and kind of guess at which parts might be true and not true. And then I go and look at the research to see if, in fact, it is true.
Yeah.
And then I review that literature and then interpret that and reach conclusions from the actual scientific studies. And that's
Yeah.
how I do my myth debugging, right? I do that in the same way when I write articles and so on for
Yeah.
the blog.
And
I start with the common feeling that people have, the sentiment that you find in social groups, and then I try and distill it down to what does the science really say about those ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I find Google Scholar and the other scientific search engines fascinating. You can read an I read an article in the paper a few years ago about pumpkin seed oil that some doctor recommended for men who got up in the middle of the night with, is it called nighttime incontinence or something that men get as they get older? And I Googled pumpkin seed oil incontinence and up it popped. And they've done lots of, studies on male population. And they found that giving them one capsule of pumpkin seed oil a day solves a lot of their problems. And I find it invaluable for looking up stuff. Could be, although my son, who's a medic, says you've got to watch it because often these studies are carried out by scientific firms and they want to prove that their skin cream is the best. And there are ways of manipulating figures, aren't there? You have to be a little bit careful the way you read it. And you have to make sure it's peer reviewed. So other people who know what they're doing can actually look at the papers and say, well, actually, we think he's skewed it or whatever.
Yeah, it is very important to read past the headlines, right?
Yeah, and that's quite difficult though, aren't they? I mean, these papers are not like bedtime reading. They you have to spend a few hours absorbing them and working out, teasing out the facts.
A lot of times the actual way in which the experiment was done is critical,
Yeah.
right? And that's buried way deep inside of the material. You can't just go by the headings.
No.
But to be honest with you, for the average person who's not familiar with scientific journals, if you read the abstract, they're usually pretty good. And then you might go down and read the conclusions. And what I have found is that a lot of times, what the news article says or what the headlines say in social media, don't agree with what's in the abstract and the conclusion, right?
No, and even when you sometimes someone publishes a paper and then a journal like New Scientist, which is, I don't know if you get that in Canada, and then you get journalists for New Scientist, which is quite a slightly heavyweight magazine, and even they, when they take the article, they make it slightly sensational. And then a newspaper like the Daily Mail pick it up over here, and they tease it out again and they make it more sensational, and it gets further and further away from what it's really saying. And that's the same the world over, isn't it? Because they want to sell copy, they want to sensationalize everything, and they remove the boring bits, which they think are boring and aren't relevant, but often they are. Yeah.
They're actually critical to understanding what the scientist actually found and what the scientist said.
Yeah, no, fascinating. So anyway, your book, so that is going to be really interesting in the UK because we're all about getting away from ultra processed foods here. I don't know if it's the same with you, but there's an awful lot of research that's come to light that ultra processed foods here, which are full of sort of high sugar, high salt, and not much protein, and they substitute other chemicals instead. And so you eat, 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 and you never feel, or you rarely feel full. You have to eat an enormous amount. And because in Britain, I think we consume more UPF, ultra processed foods, than any other country in Europe, we are a nation of fatties. And we're finding it very difficult because people naturally can consume huge amounts of sugar without turning the off button. And a food science client of mine, he's a food scientist and he worked for lots of big firms, and he says, you eat it, you can eat like three bars of chocolate and you still don't feel full. But the thing is, you've got to persuade yourself that you have delayed reward. If you can make yourself say no, not eat the ultra processed food, and then you feel good later because you haven't eaten it. But for many people, especially young children who form these habits, that's very difficult to get into. But are you the same in Canada? Are you all eating lots of ultra processed food?
We're eating way too much processed
Yeah.
food, and we are moving towards eating more natural things, and I think we probably are not that different from the UK in that respect. One of the things that I found interesting about this book, well, first of all, when I wrote the book, one of the things I had to learn a lot that I didn't know, so
Yeah.
I was learning a lot along the way. And
Of
one of the
food
things I
science.
found really interesting was the fact that humans actually are able to tell how nutritious food is naturally. That's sort of how we have evolved over time.
How do we tell? I didn't realize that. Because if you gave a baby a load of sweet foods next to some raw carrots, I think it would take the sweet, wouldn't it?
Well, it turns out they did an experiment like that. It's described in the book where they took a group of babies and they gave them a whole bunch of food to select from. They let them eat whatever they wanted. These weren't babies, but they were young kids.
Yeah.
And they were able to eat whatever they wanted. And at the end of the study, they found that all of the kids were healthy and they were eating healthy, which really surprised them. They thought that they would gravitate to food that was tastier and less healthy, but that
Yeah.
actually didn't happen. And th this was an older study that was done a while ago.
How old were the children, out of interest?
I don't remember, but I remember them being described as more like almost babies, to call them toddlers,
Toddlers,
right?
probably two-ish. Yes. Wow. You see, that
But what?
surprises me because in the UK, a lot of baby food used to be very full of sugar and processed to get the baby to eat, bananas, sweetened yogurts, that sort of thing. And I would have thought that sort of educated their palates towards wanting that sort of stuff. But
Well,
you.
that's the other side, the other end of this story is that what has happened over the years is that the manufacturers of these foods have learned that we can identify certain flavors in the food. We can actually sense the nutritional value of this food. And now they're adding substitutes that fool
Mimic.
us. They
Right.
fool us. So our bodies are eating this food, and we think we're eating healthy food when we're not, because
Right.
manufacturers have put specific things in there to basically confuse our systems.
That's fascinating. I
Okay.
didn't pick up on that. That is really interesting. I do remember my cousin when she was a toddler, age two, she used to go into the fridge and eat raw liver. And her mother was really shocked, raw liver, salmonella. But maybe it was the high iron. I mean, can you imagine eating raw liver? But there was obviously something lacking there that maybe she detected.
So it's, we're being fooled by manufacturers. So the potato chip, I think, is one of the examples I used in the book, right? Potatoes are quite healthy, And when they make potato chips, they can make potato chips also healthy. But in fact, they add things in there to make them taste really healthy to us. So we actually eat too many of them. And then they're not good for us, right? So there's nothing inherently wrong with potato chips. But the fact that they make them in such a way that we eat more and more of them, we're actually eating too much of them now.
Is that because of the monosodium glutamate? I've always thought that that makes you want more of it.
Yeah, I don't know specifically which compounds they're putting in there, but they're putting in certain flavoring that makes us eat more.
Yeah,
It
that.
basically they're confusing our minds into eating more than we really need.
Yeah. And I think it is that salt sugar combination that is the secret thing, isn't it? This salted caramel flavor. In Britain, it came in about 10 years ago, and that has added to ice cream, sweets, everything. And
Everything.
that people just love because it's salt and sugar, but really bad for you.
Right.
But the good news is that I think as a gardener, we tend to be more healthy. I don't know if you would agree with this, but a study with 140,000 gardeners said we're significantly less likely to have type 2 diabetes. Now, whether this is because we exercise a bit more, because it is pretty good exercise if you're out there regularly and it's a good habit, because we do eat higher fiber diets, they found, and we do have a much healthier stomach microbiome. So maybe it's all those things, do you think? I mean, I do think that gardening is one of the best habits to develop if you like it, because it's for your health and for happiness.
Well, this is one of the big problems with human studies is it's very easy to create some links between these things. So you might conclude that, well, gardeners are healthier, they eat healthier and so on. But you also always have to look at the cause of these things. And it's very hard to determine what the cause of these are. So gardeners may be healthier because they are people who believe strongly in being healthier, and because of that, they garden. It doesn't mean that the gardening is making them healthy, right?
But they tested their microbiome and they found their microbiome was much more diverse than non-gardeners.
Yeah, but we know the honesty truth about microbiome was that we know very little about it.
But far
And
more than we did 10 years ago. We're really getting
that's
there
true.
now.
We know more, but we still know very little about it. So for someone to come along and say, well, you have a more diverse microbiome, and because of that, you're healthier, that connection you can't make.
So with your latest book, you're on the food science. What did you discover that you found most interesting, that you surprised you?
I think the biggest single message we have to let people know is that we know very little about the nutrition of food. Okay. Now, if you read the headlines and all the conclusions, it sounds as if we know all kinds of things. One type of tomato is more nutritious than another type, or oranges are more nutritious, and so on. So we have to first start at the basics and ask the question, what is nutrition? Right? We don't have a definition for nutrition, which I think will surprise most of your listeners. And the reason is that we don't even know which compounds are important in that equation. So when we talk about nutrition and you read headlines, there's lots about vitamin C and the minerals and calcium. Now we talk about antioxidants, but in fact, we don't even know how many nutritious compounds there are. We are pretty sure now it's in the thousands of compounds. Okay, so let's call this 3,000 compounds, which could be 10,000, but let's say it's three. We're pretty sure it's at least 3,000. We haven't measured those 3,000 nutrients in any single food item.
No, and a
Okay.
lot of them are the antioxidants, aren't they, and things like that, which we're only recently beginning to understand how complex and how many of them there are.
Right. So the bottom line here is that A, we cannot define the nutrition of a food. We have really no way of measuring the nutrition of a food because we can't define it. What we are able to do is to pick one or two or maybe even six of those 3,000 compounds and measure those.
Yeah.
And then we end up with a big headline that says, oh, A is more nutritious than B. But it's only based on looking at six out of 3,000 compounds.
Yes.
We don't know what the rest do. So we cannot conclude that A is more nutritious than B. So
right.
that I think is a really, really important message that everyone has to understand, which basically means that most of the headlines you've read about nutrition don't really tell you very much because they haven't looked at all of these compounds.
Yeah.
The second thing that I think is really important that people have to understand is that for our societies, for North America and Europe and developed countries, we actually have an excess of food, and we don't have nutrient deficiencies for most of us. So when we ask what is a nutritious compound, let's take vitamin C, for instance. Most people will agree vitamin C is one of those nutrients that we need. But in fact, most of us get too much of it. And the excess, we just urinate out. It's just wasted.
Yeah.
So the fact that, tomato A has higher vitamin C than tomato B is of no consequence and of no value to us because we already get too much vitamin C in our diets.
Yeah.
So when we look at nutrition, we have to correct the nutritional values based on what we're short of. What are we needing? It's kind of like fertilizing plants, the way we started the conversation, right? We need to figure out which nutrients are we lacking, and then those have to be the nutrients we are concerned about. Another one is magnesium and calcium, for instance. We get lots of magnesium and calcium in our diet. So the fact that one carrot has more calcium than another is of really no value to us, right? Because we get enough in our diet. But
Well, we do here, but maybe not so much in Japan. You see, we've got hard water. Have you got hard water?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I think maybe in certain countries they are a bit low in calcium.
Right. And that's
but not here.
And that's a valid point. The things that are of nutritious value do depend on your diet and where you live.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So this whole discussion of nutrition has to be brought back to a specific location and a specific kind of diet, right? For many people around the world, vitamin C is critical. It is a nutrient they need because they don't get enough of it. And that's
that would
another
probably be
reason.
in the northern, like in Iceland and places where you would you think where you'll
Well,
get
places where people just don't get enough fresh fruits and vegetables, which
yeah
is like half the world, right?
yeah
So in undeveloped countries, vitamin C is really critical for us, And I think that's maybe another important message for people to understand is that nutrition, the science of nutrition, is actually a very young subject. Right, it's not like physics and chemistry that have been around for hundreds of years. The science of nutrition only started like 70 years ago, 50, 70 years ago, where we started looking at things. So most of what we know about nutrition is just scraping the surface of the subject. And as we learn more, we do come up with all kinds of these rules. Like, a few years ago, we were told that sugar is no longer good for us and we shouldn't have sugar. And that's really not true either. We do need some sugar in our diet. We just have to reduce the amount of sugar that we use. Cholesterol also is one of those things that, at one point cholesterol was bad for everybody. And now we understand that some cholesterol is actually good for us. And some types are bad for us. So as we move along and there's more and more science done, we're going to fine tune a lot of this and understand it better.
But one of the things that did come out from your book was that the freshness was fairly critical for some things. I mean, certainly if you're a gardener growing your own, you can pick it really fresh and it tastes better, which is number one. I think nearly always it tastes better when it's fresh, whether it's a lettuce, carrot, or whatever. And it does tend to have a higher nutrient level because some of the ones do denature a bit after picking.
Right. Well, that's overall, that's generally true, but maybe we've over exaggerated the value of that. So the science seems to indicate that fresh is 10 to 15% more nutritious than older vegetables. But again, we have to look at this from two different points of view. So, for instance, fresh is best. But the fact that I can import a fruit from around the world all year long, and even though it's not fresh when I get it, nutritionally, I'm better off having access to that food than not having access to that food, right?
Yes, yeah.
So in the old days, we only ate food that was grown locally, right? And so we only had certain foods for a few weeks of the year, and then they were gone, and we didn't have them all year. Now we have access to that food all year long. Now, granted, it's shipped, it's not as fresh, but we have access to more of it. So, in fact, the fact that we can ship that across the country and have it available every day in our grocery stores actually gives us access to more nutrition that way.
Yeah, obviously, you get
Now,
a
it
much
is
more diverse diet,
right.
obviously. I mean,
Now,
in winter.
it is certainly true that from a gardener's perspective, the most nutritious, well, sorry, let me correct that. The food from our gardens is certainly fresher, right? There's no doubt about that. And getting
And
it
tastier,
and
sometimes too
tastier,
much. Yeah.
in part because you can pick it at the stage you want, right?
Yeah.
It hasn't been picked early and shipped and so on. So it's tastier from that point of view. Our own food is also tastier because we can select cultivars that have the flavor we want, right? So I can grow a thousand different tomatoes and I can grow the ones that I really enjoy the most. So the thing out of my garden is very flavorful to me because I've selected the cultivar I like.
Whereas when you're stocking your supermarket shelves as a storeholder, you usually stock for longest shelf life, toughest so they don't bruise in transportation, and what's readily available, which is very rarely flavor driven, is it?
That's right. And but there's a good reason for that. And I know a lot of people complain about the flavor of these vegetables in stores. But from a nutritional point of view, we're better off having that vegetable that's a little less flavorful and having access all year long. It makes us healthier beings, right? Now, what is happening now is that now that we've gotten these vegetables to a point where we can ship them and they survive reasonably well. Now, a lot of people are returning back to making them taste better. And so, we're going to see in the next little while, we're going to add those flavor compounds back into these fruits.
Yeah, they are definitely doing more research with that in mind. Yeah, absolutely. But also, it worries me that they're breeding everything for sweetness. You know, sweet corn now is so sweet. Apples are so sweet. They seem to be changing our palate and really driving up the sweetness level. And so with tomatoes, something that like Sungold, which has a bit more acid in it as well as sugar, is much better. I don't know if you have Sungold over with you.
Yeah, we do.
We
Yeah.
do, but I do worry at the amount of sugar that they're pumping into these varieties to make us buy them more, because it does seem to be all sugar driven. And with sweet corn, we used to say, I don't know what you feel about this, that you have to pick it from your garden, have the water boiling, and then cook it as quick as you can because the sugar changes the starch, which isn't so nice. But now all the sweet corns that you buy in shops are so sweet, even the ones that you grow are so sweet. It makes little difference, that quick time from picking to cooking. Would you agree?
I still find that they have to be fresh. We usually We go and buy it and pretty much eat them the same day we buy them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right. And when you don't grow them in your garden then? No.
No, they take up way too much space.
You're 6 acres. Yes, absolutely. So although you can get very fresh vegetables and fruit when you buy from a supermarket, if you buy from your own, then I can grow a much wider range than I could ever buy from a supermarket. I mean, I had a salad yesterday in sort of very beginning of April with 10, 12 different types of things in it picked from the garden. And I always think a wide range, as you say, because we know so little about nutrition, at least if you have a fairly wide range, I think you are hopefully getting a more diverse source of nutrients. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's really the secret is to have a lot of variety and smaller amounts of each one of those. And certainly gardening makes that much easier because you can control what you have available.
And when I work in Japan and we go out to restaurants there, their diet is so wide compared to ours, far more things. And I think they are a very healthy nation in many ways. So that's a big advantage of growing your own. And the freshness helps with certain things for sure. This whole thing with spinach is, I mean, I remember we always used to say as kids that Popeye, do you have Popeye in Canada, was
I grew up with.
Boulevard and big tough guy. And actually, you're saying, well, I think they discovered some time ago that a lot of it is locked up with oxalic acid. Is that
Correct.
right?
Yes.
So
Yes.
you can eat bowls and bowls of spinach, but because it's all locked up with oxalic acid, you're not necessarily getting a lot of iron.
Well, you're getting a lot less iron than you think. The interesting thing is that the microbes in our gut system help free that iron, right? So they when we take it into our mouth and it goes through our stomach, the oxalic acid still holds onto that iron, and we can't really use it. But there are microbes in there that separate those two. They free up the iron, and then we can use the iron.
But do we all have those microbes or not?
Well, we don't know much about our microbiome, so we don't really know, but we probably do. A lot of the microbes will do a similar type of reaction, so you don't necessarily need a particular species of microbe to do that.
And this oxalic acid, you know, we always ask on Gardener's Question Time, should I put spinach leaves on, not sorry, rhubarb leaves on the compost heap? It's high in oxalic acid toxin. But you point out that actually parsley has higher oxalic acid.
So the spinach thing or the rhubarb story never made any sense to me because the leaf and the stem are actually both part of a leaf, right? The stem is not a stem, it's a petiole of the leaf. And why would the plant put a lot of oxalic in one and not in the other? And so when I looked up the numbers, it turns out leaves and the stems that we eat have about the same amount of oxalic acid. And that other vegetables like parsley have, I think we have four times as much oxalic acid as rhubarb has. So you could actually eat those leaves. You can certainly put them in your compost pile. It's not going to make any difference. And we're over concerned about the toxicity of rhubarb. And when I looked for actual studies of people dying from eating rhubarb leaves, there doesn't seem to be any documented data for that. So there's no evidence that people actually died from eating rhubarb leaves.
No, it certainly, I've never seen any either. So you just wonder how anything like that came about. I remember I worked one day with Raymond Blanc, who's a French chef who works in England, has a Michelin star restaurant, and we cooked in the kitchen together. And he was showing me how he always cooks his vegetables. He doesn't steam them, he doesn't boil them. He puts a bit of fat in the pan, maybe a teaspoon of butter, chops his carrots or cabbage or sprouts or whatever into tiny bits, throws them in, adds maybe a dessert spoon of water, salt and pepper. And he quickly cooks them over fairly high heat. So they are cooked in what's termed an emulsion, really. And he always says, why do English people bung their veg into loads of boiling water and then tip all that stuff, the vitamins and flavor, down the sink? Now, do you think, chemically speaking, that when we cook vegetables Raymond's way, and I always do that now because they are much more delicious and you're not chucking that stuff down the sink, but do you think things like vitamin C, which is water soluble, would stay in? And for things like vitamin D and E, which are they fat soluble? I think D is, isn't
I
it?
think B is,
An A is, I think. And would they stay in there? Would we, or will they be denatured by the heating anyway, because they're protein, so we'll be killing them off with the heat anyway?
right. So two things happen. If we cook things in water, then the water soluble vitamins tend to come out of the vegetables and go into the water. But
And that
again,
will be vitamin C, and
We're
which
not
other one?
talking about, 90% of the vitamins. We're talking, I think for vitamin C, the numbers were something like 20 to 30% might come out into the water. The rest of it stays in the vegetable.
Ah, so it's a small amount.
It's not like the water is able to suck every vitamin C molecule out of a vegetable, right? So you're losing some.
But what
Now, the
about the
same.
heat then? Will the heat, will that
Well,
denature it,
yeah.
the
So
vitamin?
if we look at the heating in oil, we have the
Yeah.
same thing going on because we have water soluble vitamins and they are extracted in oil.
Are they?
Okay. The
Oh,
third
really?
thing that happens is that all these molecules have some sensitivity to heat, right? And so higher temperatures tend to degrade these molecules more than lower temperatures.
Yes,
Okay. And
that makes sense.
each molecule, each type of vitamin or each type of antioxidant molecule or these 3,000 molecules that we've been talking about will be affected differently by temperature. Now, in some cases, the temperature actually degrades the molecule of interest, but turns it into something else that could actually be more valuable to us nutritionally than the one we started with.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, this is one of these things where we pick on vitamin C and say, well, don't boil your vegetables because you're degrading it. First of all, it comes into the water and then the heat degrades it, and you lose it, so it's less nutritious. But what about all these other things in there? Many of them don't degrade. Many of them won't come into the water.
Right.
Now, I think that from a cooking perspective, the best way to do it is to try to keep your temperature lower, because then the temperature affects things less. And whatever you're cooking it in, use small amounts and eat it, right? So if you cook it in water and it's only a small amount of water and you use it as to make gravy, then you're not losing it. You're
Yeah.
just moving it around, right? And the other thing to understand, and this goes back to some gardening myths, is that when we boil vegetables and we take this water off the vegetables, it's kind of greenish color usually. And so people now use that to fertilize their plants because they think all these nutrients have come out of the vegetables. But the amount of nutrients in that water is very, very low.
Yeah.
Okay. Most of it's still in the vegetable.
Right.
So
Oh, that's reassuring.
using
Yeah.
that water for watering your plants is okay because it's better than putting it down the sink, but it's not really feeding your plants. And boiling it, unless you're really boiling to extensive amounts for long periods of time, most of those nutrients are still in the vegetables that you're going to eat.
And
So
some,
I
yeah.
think it's better that the advice people should be given is cook it the way you enjoy it, because that makes you eat more vegetables. And that's much better than any loss you might incur during the cooking process, right? Don't focus so much on losing a little bit of one or two vitamins in the cooking process. Focus on cooking the food the way you enjoy it so you actually eat more of it.
And also, you make the very good point in your book, is that some vegetables are actually better for you cooked than raw. Because I always tend to have a big salad every day. I'm thinking that raw is best, but you're saying certain vegetables, which would you say are best cooked from the
You know, I
nutrient?
think if I remember correctly, the cole crops, things like broccoli and Brussels sprouts and so on, They actually become healthier if we cook them, because
Right.
there are compounds in there that break down, and our digestive system becomes better able to extract those nutrients once that vegetable is cooked. Right. So
Right.
eating raw is not always the best. And
Yeah.
it's going to depend on the actual vegetable, and it's going to depend on the nutrient that we're trying to extract. Right. And this gets back to this, you know, is it nutritious? Well, the most nutritious food is the one that gives us the nutrients we need.
Yeah.
Right. The one that we're short of.
And
And
we
if
don't know always,
and
do we?
we don't know. Well, we never know, right,
We never
what
know.
we're really
So we
short
want to go
of. So
diverse.
we
And
want
maybe we would
diverse.
cook a bit of raw. Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of
Okay.
everything. And again, I think, you know, rather than arguing about, well, should we eat it raw or cooked or so on, if you like it cooked, eat it cooked. If you like it raw, eat it raw. Raw is better than none, right? And
Yes.
I think that's really the message. We want to eat more of these vegetables, and we might as well cook them the way we like. Now, if we don't care whether they're cooked or raw, then in some cases we're better off cooking them a little bit.
Right, okay. Now, all these antioxidants that we're all becoming aware of now, or phytonutrients, if there's at least 25,000 different types. I mean, people might recognize carotenoids, flavonoids, sulforaphane, things like that. But these give rise often to different colorations, and eating the rainbow, as you say, is very popular expression.
Right.
The idea is you just eat a lot of different coloured fruit and vegetables, but also white and green. We forget that actually white and green, as you point out, are really, really good.
Right. So these are some of these compounds have color, but
Yeah.
they don't all have color. So it is certainly a mistake to think that, you know, we have to have the color in order to eat antioxidants. Okay,
Yeah.
there are antioxidants that don't have color, and so we have to also eat vegetables that don't have color. And each color is a different group of compounds. So the bluer vegetables have one group of compounds, the red ones have a different group of compounds. But we're starting to understand that there are many of these antioxidant compounds. And although we call them all antioxidants, and that isn't incorrect, they're all different. Okay. In the same way that we call a lot of these compounds vitamins, they're not all the same. They're different, but we still call them vitamins. And we're finding out that the same happens with antioxidants. Each one of these compounds has a specific chemical role in our bodies and do something for us. And so we really need all of them, right?
And
And
they
so
also help mop up the free radicals, don't they? Now, we always think of free radicals as the baddies.
yeah.
Would you agree with that? And that they sort of cause cancer and that sort of thing. And there's that whole thing about eating blueberries and how they were meant to be amazing. But you point out an interesting point about blueberries and free radicals, don't you? And so do you eat blueberries or not? Because I remember it came over to the UK maybe 10 years ago, and everybody was buying blueberries and eating them.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
they thought these were the magic cure-all to cancer because they're going to mop up the free radicals.
Yeah. So there's a couple. I eat blueberries, but I eat them because I like them, not necessarily because they're blue.
Yeah.
But I like fruit in general, so I eat them. Certainly colored food like that is healthier. So these free radicals, you can think of them as these are byproducts that our body produces. So we have lots of chemical reactions going on in our body all the time, and we produce free radicals. And these free radicals are compounds that are basically toxic to us. So even though our body's producing them, they're toxic to us. And if we have too many of them, there are certainly indications that they can cause cancer. Okay. So how do we get rid of these? Well, there's another chemical reaction, and it's called an antioxidant. An antioxidant comes along and picks up and reacts with these free radicals and basically makes them so that they're not toxic. Right. So that's how the story goes. And in theory, that will prevent us from getting cancer. Okay. Now, from my reading, is that association is still kind of weak. It's certainly possible, and it certainly looks like these antioxidants are healthy for us, but there isn't a real direct link yet, but there probably will be. So eating a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, and all fruits and vegetables have some of these in there. You, no matter what you eat, you're going to have antioxidants in there. It's just that some particular things have more. So blueberries tend to have a particular blue antioxidant, has more than other things. And that's why it gets picked on, right? So we talk about this rainbow of vegetables. We want all the different colors because we get a good mixture. We get a good variety.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly, I just yesterday received my my purple tomato seeds, which were developed in the UK, and they're the first GMO tomatoes, and they're going to be really blue, and they have the same antioxidant that blueberries have.
What is the variety of them? What's the varietal
It's
name?
All purple.
It's just called all purple.
It's purple. That is the cultivar name.
Oh, right, right.
But
I mean, there's quite a few purple ones here.
But these ones are really purple, both inside and outside.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I'll look out for those. Yes, so you'll be very healthy. Now, the other thing is peeling. So again, Raymond Blanc, back to him at the Manoir, he said at home he would never peel a potato because it's got flavour, it's got nutrient. But in his restaurant, Michelin star restaurant, if he served mashed potato with the peel on, people would go, oh my God, I wouldn't eat it. But actually, generally, is it right to think that the peel is high nutrient in carrots, potatoes, Jerusalem artichokes, all those sort of things? Do you keep the peel on?
I'm not sure that I would say they're high in nutritional value. I can't imagine why a plant would take all these chemicals and put them out into the peel and not in the rest of the food, right?
I just thought maybe
So,
the differentiation of cells, maybe those have different chemicals than the inner. So you've got a wider range and you do have more flavor with a potato. The potato peel is very tasty.
It may have. The other thing about potatoes is potatoes also contain toxins.
So
And most of the toxins are also in the skin, right? And that's one reason you peel particularly greenish to potatoes. So potatoes that have kind of a greenish skin, it's better to take the peel off because that skin is actually toxic to us.
Yeah, we would do that in the UK. If it's green, we wouldn't eat it. But if it's white, we never associate that with toxins. And many people eat baked potatoes in their jackets and things. So I don't think it's a high level of toxin, is it? And when it's cooked,
it depends on the potato. So we have in fact developed naturally bred potatoes that were so toxic they had to be taken off the market.
The
And in
skin
fact,
or all the potato was toxic.
well, I don't know exactly where it was, but the whole potato was too toxic to eat.
And that was this, is it solanin? What is the chemical in
It, it, it's
potatoes?
the solanine is one of the chemicals, yes.
Right.
And then the
That's
potato, I think,
interesting.
was called Lenapo. It
So
was.
do you eat potato skins? Do you eat baked potatoes?
Yeah, I eat the skins. I don't peel them.
Because you don't think there's enough in there to worry about if it's on the market.
I don't think it's enough to worry about.
Good, 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 good. Okay, and eggs, your thing about eggs was interesting because you said that a deep yellow pigment in an egg yolk, and quite a few British gardeners will have a few chickens, and that's due to beta carotene, xanthophyll, and lycopene, three phytonutrients, which is good news. I didn't realise that. I love my chickens' eggs because when you get a chicken, then it's usually come from inside, and the eggs are very pale to start with, and then you put them on the grass, and within a few days they go this beautiful bright yellow. And I'm glad I didn't realise. I thought it was just aesthetics, but they are actually better for you. But what worried me about what you said is never eat them raw, because I will make a pint of mayonnaise a week from my chicken's eggs, and I often eat them raw. But and you said because of the bacteria, I've forgotten which one it is now, that salmonella. But would you? So you never eat a raw egg mayonnaise?
I don't eat mayonnaise, no.
I've never been ill from it, I have
but
to say.
not but not because I think it's toxic. I just don't eat mayonnaise and I don't eat raw eggs.
Right.
I think the message is that it's one of these warning things that particularly governments are very popular in issuing, right? So there is a slim chance of you getting fungal infection from raw eggs. So it is safer to cook them, right?
Fungal or bacterial? I thought it's bacterial.
Or a bacterial infection, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah, but for someone like me who's eaten raw eggs all her life, it would be well, I suppose the chicken could eat a bacteria that could come through to me that I've never come across before. So I wouldn't have the immunity, but I'm not exactly dicing with death, am I?
Well, maybe not up to this point, but maybe tomorrow.
Yes. Right, okay. And
So
honey.
some of these warning things, you know, they're there for safety reasons. The number of cases that actually happen are usually pretty low.
Yeah.
But particularly when you're writing a book, you want to, you know, err on the side of caution. So
you don't want to be sued. Your solicitors wouldn't like that. And the other thing I wondered about was honey, because we've had bees, so I will always use honey in preference to sugar. And you said, well, actually, they're just as high in sugar, so none is sugar is not honey is not better than sugar. But it does have antimicrobial things, doesn't it, honey? And
Yeah.
it has your helps your cardiovascular activities. It contains phenols, flavonoids, high antioxidants. So I would always die for the honey pot rather than the sugar jar.
Well, you have to go back and find out what is the amount of each of those compounds in honey and compare that to the amount of honey you eat. So is that making any difference? Because 99.9% of honey is sugar. Okay, so you're still getting
You
the sugar.
spoil sport, really. So
So
it's
sugar and
very
water, it's
little.
basically sugar and water. These other compounds are going to be there in very, very low amounts. And I bet you'd be hard-pressed finding any science that shows you that honey is actually more nutritious. I mean,
Well,
sorry, let me restate that. The honey may have some of these compounds in there, but it's always important to understand the quantity of these things. And if the quantity is very low, then the benefit is also very low.
right. I mean, I do know if you ever have a stomach upset, food poisoning or something, and you have this might just be circumstantial, and you have some Manuka honey or something, it seems to help clear it up quicker than many things, but you'll say there's no scientific evidence to prove that, but I find it very handy.
Well, I'd like to see some scientific studies on that.
You're right, I'm sure. Okay, so the other thing you mention in your book is home remedies for pests and disease and things. And you basically say that a lot of these home remedies are actually not very good and some of them are even toxic. I mean, salt, I think, is the case in point, isn't it? People say salt for weed killers, using on asparagus, and it's actually pretty toxic to soil and plant life. And probably many people say it's more toxic than glyphosate. I don't know what you think, but are there any home remedies that you think that you can spray on your vegetables that you think are better than nothing at all, basically?
What I tell people is that 95% of the home remedies they read about or hear about don't work. Very few of them will actually harm anything, but they just don't work. So I have found a couple that do work. One is milk. So if you take milk and mix it to sort of 25% milk, 75% water, and spray plants with it, it does prevent powdery mildew. And
we
it
find
probably
that a lot in the UK. We use it a lot, for that.
Yeah. And it probably prevents other types of fungal infection, but it doesn't cure. Okay, that's important people understand. So what we think happens with the milk is that it changes the pH on the surface of the leaf and it prevents the fungal spores from germinating.
You have to reapply it, don't you, quite
You have
frequently.
to reapply it because it gets washed off. And it doesn't affect a fungus that has already infected the plant.
Got
So
inside the plant cells.
If you see white on your plant, it will not reduce the amount of whiteness on your plant. What it does is prevents more whiteness from infecting the plant.
So you're better off pulling off those leaves that are heavily infected and spraying the young leaves, would you say?
Well, that's a
In
very
that scheme.
common advice, and I don't agree with it.
But why would you leave them on there if you're going to spray it with milk? Because surely you're going to leave on a big source of infection, heavily concentrated source of infection.
Well, I look at infection and I look at how much of it is on the leaf. If you have a leaf that is half green and half white, the half green is still working for the plant.
Yeah,
All right.
but I'm
So
talking about heavily powdered
if
milk.
we pull that leaf off, then the plant no longer has the leaf. So we've actually damaged the plant. Once it gets to about 80% coverage, then you might as well take it off because it's probably harming the plant with it on more than taking it off. So I'm very much against pulling off every leaf that has a little speck on it, which is a
Now, I
very
agree with
common
you,
advice
yeah.
in gardening.
But if it's heavily infected, then we both agree it is worth removing it.
Then it's worth removing it because then it's actually the fungus is actually taking nutrients out of the plant. So at some point, the plant is actually losing nutrients to the fungus.
Right.
Right?
And the other one that you say is good, then you said milk is one that works. Which other one? Home remedy.
Baking soda is the other one. So baking soda and water will work the same way for powdery mildew. And again, we're pretty sure it's a change of the pH on the leaf. It
A
prevents.
baking soda is sodium carbonate, is that right?
It is sodium carbonate.
Sodium carbonate, right, okay, yeah.
And it's better to use potassium carbonate than the sodium.
Can you get that regularly?
Well, I don't know what you mean by regularly, but you can find it usually in specialty food stores.
Oh, right, okay. I've only ever seen sodium
But
carbonate over here, but I'll have a look.
the common one is sodium, and because of the sodium in there, we know the sodium is toxic to plants, but you're using a relatively small amount of it. But potassium carbonate would be a better choice, and in fact, the potassium carbonate seems to work better.
And what sort of dilution rate do you use on
You'd
that?
have to come to my website and look that up.
Okay.
There is an article on powdery mildew on gardenmyths.com, and it goes through both of those, sodium and potassium, and gives you the concentrations to use. It was
Lovely.
actually, there's a formula that was developed by the Cornell University in the States, and they tested it. And the
Yeah.
other thing you actually add is a bit of oil. And you don't need the oil, but the oil and the potassium bicarbonate is more effective than either one separately.
Right,
But
okay. And is
again,
that included?
this is a preventative technique. You want to spray your plants before they get the fungus,
Yeah, that's
right?
where we're bad at, because they look healthy and then suddenly they creep up on you, don't they? And
Right.
if you don't watch them, I mean, someone said the best fertilizer in a garden is the shadow of the gardener. And it's things like this, isn't it? It's catching it before it gets too bad, which we can fall down on. So the other thing is the Brix value. BRIX, and this is basically a thing of sugar, a quantity of sugar that's in the plant. So if you don't water your tomatoes so much, you will tend to have a higher Brix concentration and they will taste sweeter. Would you agree with that?
That's right.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing that a lot of gardeners fall down on here, because they either seem to slap on loads of water. I think it's this caring for bit, you know, you feel like you're doing something, or else they just splash on tiny amounts, which do absolutely no good at all. But I always think with watering, it's best to give them the very least amount you can get away with to get a decent crop. And then you do get sweeter, better tasting crops, would you say?
It depends on the actual crop. So some things actually improve in flavor if we water a little less, and other crops actually improve in flavor if we water more.
Like
So it really
lettuce,
depends
perhaps.
on the plant and how that food is developing. It is important that we keep the plants growing well.
Yes.
Right? And so and things like peas and beans, which are actually growing and developing, they need a fair amount of moisture. And if we cut back on the moisture too much, then they tend to get woodier. Okay, so the texture now affects the flavor. Remember,
Particularly
flavor
when they're
is not the.
flowering and setting fruit, isn't it, with peas and beans, do you find?
I'm sorry?
Particularly when they're flowering and setting fruit, you need to keep the water
Correct.
on them. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. See, on a tomato, we've reached a point where the tomato was ripe as far as the plant is concerned when it gets a little blush.
Yeah.
Okay. A red tomato is not a ripe tomato as far as the plant is concerned. As far as the plant is concerned, a red tomato is an overripe, rotting fruit.
But they do taste better when
They
they're
taste better.
overripe. Yeah.
From a human perspective, it's ripe when it's red and juicy, but
Yeah.
that's not from the plant's perspective. Whereas a bean and pea, we tend to pick before it's ripe, assuming we're picking green peas and beans, right?
Yeah.
We're picking them before they're ripe. So the plant and the human has a different perspective on what is ripe.
Yeah, but we're growing them for us, not for the plants.
That's true. But we are watering for the plant. And so when we're watering, we want to water based on what the plant needs, and the plant's trying to ripen that food. So when it's trying to ripen food, we want to keep it well watered. Once it's ripe, it no longer needs so much water.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely right, I'm sure.
Okay.
I'll just do some quick points. So, organically grown food, you point out, is no more nutritious than conventionally grown food. Yeah.
Correct.
So many people would say, well, inorganic is often full of chemicals, but you point out that actually all plants are full of chemicals anyway, and it makes little difference. Heirloom varieties you don't think are any more nutritious than hybrids, and I agree that that's right. People just like growing some heirlooms because they don't want to lose them, and they don't want those genes to go by the wayside, really. And that nutrient densities vary significantly among cultivars, but we would never know that. But if you mix and match, and you hope you're getting a nice balance, really.
Yeah, gardeners have no way of knowing how nutrient dense the food is that they're producing.
Yeah. Right, okay. So, and what would you say then is your top tip if you're talking to gardeners, they're growing their own veg, they want them to be as healthy as possible. So can you just give us three things that we should bear in mind when we're growing our own fruit and veg so we can be as healthy as we think we can
Right.
be possible?
Since we don't know what the nutritional value is, I think gardeners should focus on quantity. So grow things that give you a good yield. If
Yeah.
you grow more and eat it, you will be healthier. Okay. Number two is to grow the things you like to eat. Don't grow 20 different things because you think you should grow it. Grow the food that you really like to eat and you really enjoy fresh from the garden. And I would focus on that. The third thing is you're better off growing a smaller number of things, particularly for a new grower, than growing a lot of things. If you're a new grower, focus on two or three vegetables, forget all the others, and pick the things that are easier to grow.
And
I
what would you
do.
put those as? With you, they'll probably be different for me.
Well, it will depend on climate,
Yeah.
certainly. So, for instance, I will grow tomatoes, although I don't consider them easy to grow because they do get diseases and a bunch of other things. And our season is
Inside,
kind of
though. You
short.
would grow them inside.
No, outside in the garden, but I start
No,
them
no.
inside. But
Right,
yeah,
yes.
I grow beans because they give you big yield, low pests, very little to do. You just plant them and you get beans.
Runner beans.
We actually don't grow a lot of runner beans. We're mostly growing green beans, but I grow
French
runner
beans.
beans.
Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
right.
Okay.
I grow peas because I find we can start them early and our climate's cool enough and we get a good yield. Right.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
don't grow a lot of things like broccoli and kale because they're difficult to grow. At least around here, they're not an easy vegetable. So,
Lots of pests take a long, long time,
I'm,
but very nutritious.
carrots are easy to grow, so grow carrots. Onions, garlic are easy to grow those. Right?
Yeah, no, that.
So, yeah, I have a video with the 10 best vegetables, and it's really based on how easy they are to grow. I pick the ones that have the least amount of pests and diseases. And if you start with those, you'll be successful.
Yeah. And my final question before we finish is, I usually bring my guests a present, but because we're virtual, I can't do it. But if you had a wand and you could wave and get something for your garden, be it a plant, be it a product, what would you get for your garden that you haven't got? I've stumped him here. He's
I
got
have
everything.
no idea. I usually have to see a new plant that I don't have, then I want it, just say.
Yes, you get fear of missing out.
I grow over 3,000 different kinds of plants, so I have a lot of what I want.
Okay. So you
But
wouldn't have a natural swimming pool or anything like that in your garden?
no, I wouldn't add that. A helper now that I've gotten older, a helper is very good to have in the
Okay, I'll give you a garden helper. Yeah, one day a week, just one day a week. You've got to keep fit, and that is important. If you keep gardening, you'll keep fit. So I'll only let you have him one day a week, or
All
her. Okay.
right.
Well, thank you very much, Robert.